Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
It's time now for Radio I on ABC Radio National.
I'm going to tell you how to do resuscitation, all right?
They can be warped or distorted.
It's just a luck of the draw.
Graphic representation of sound.
And then just gone plop, splat.
That's what I call the plane of cohesion.
I just felt every eye was on me.
Radio I.
Hi, welcome to the program. I'm Brent Clough. Today's feature, a drifting coconut, takes us far out to sea, about 80 kilometres northeast of Bougainville, in the western Pacific Ocean, to the Carteret Islands, a string of low-lying coral atolls that are disappearing into the ocean faster than they can be explained by predicted rises in sea level. On a king tide, the islands flood and the food gardens are destroyed. Yet despite this, the Carteret Islanders cling to their remaining land in a desperate desire to keep their culture alive. Last year, Thomas Parkinson went to the Carteret Islands to witness the impact of rising sea levels on the communities of the Western Pacific. What he found there was much more than a scientific problem. He found a people and a culture all at sea.
These are our islands. We've lived there for centuries. Because of the global warming and the rising of sea level, we're a victim. And we have been marginalized. We have become the poorest of the poor. We are the neglected. And we feel helpless sometimes. We are the world's first environmental refugees.
That was Bernard Tunham, a community leader from the low-lying Carteret Islands. The Carteret Islands are classically beautiful and less than a metre and a half above current sea levels. The Pacific Ocean will rise by as much as 1 metre by the end of the century. Bernard and his fellow islanders are about to become the first indigenous culture to lose their traditional land as a result of climate change. It is inevitable that these islands will disappear. What is not clear is why they are disappearing quicker than anticipated.
Well, I was born and I grew up on the atolls. And it was beautiful to grow up on the islands because we knew each other. There weren't too many people then and life was easy going and people had plenty of food to eat then that time. Because we had our swamp taro. We never really ate rice. We basically ate swamp taro, bananas, cassava, and breadfruit. So there was plenty food then that time.
That was Ursula Rokova. I travelled to the Carterets to see the effects of climate change on a culture. Ursula is helping to organise the relocation of the islanders.
I think over the last 20 years, we basically have seen the shorelines, eroding of the shorelines has been really extreme. When I was a small girl, we didn't really face major occurrences where the sea was continuously coming onto the land. It was something that wasn't really a regular occurrence. Now, basically, the current is getting stronger and the shorelines are being eroded really fast. Areas where we used to walk before, we are now paddling canoes on them. And it's really amazing because when I was a small girl, the land was kind of really big. And every time I go back to the islands, I see that the land is just getting smaller and smaller each year.
Bernard tells a story about the spirit who visited the island to give it prosperity and keep it fertile. But before he could leave his blessing, he was turned away.
One time, he was going fishing and he told his wife, I'll be away for a while. There's a spirit coming to give us blessing and bring prosperous to our garden, or a garden will bear plenty of fruits. And when he comes and I'm not here, please, you don't shut the door from him. You welcome him until I come back. So he went out fishing, and while he was away, this spirit came, and the wife was so scared, didn't want to open the door. And so the spirit said, "Who is Matanachil? I want to see him." And the lady replied and said, "He's not here, he's gone out fishing." "Okay. I wanted Matanachil to be here so that I give him the blessing, and your island would be prosperous in many things. You'll be blessed with fish, you'll be blessed with whatever grows on the island. But since you don't want me, and Matanachil is not also here, he's lied to me, I'm going with whatever I'm supposed to be giving you." So he left, and when Matanachil came back, did the spirit came? He asked his wife, and the wife said, "Yes, but I was so nervous, I got scared you were not here, and I thought he would kill me." So that's the omen we are facing at the moment. That's the old legend, you know.
The Carteret Islanders have a matrilineal society. Women are traditional owners of the land and make decisions regarding it. Ursula's mother is the owner of the island of Wene. She will pass on guardianship to Ursula, who will in turn pass it on to her daughter. The question I'm left with is, will there be anything for women like Ursula to pass on?
Land and decision is basically handed down from the women's line, and that is from mother to daughter. I have been basically my mom owns an atoll, and that's where I live now. That land, because it belonged to my mother, it then will come to me and then to my daughter. So this is basically how land is passed down from mother to daughter in our society, and also decisions regarding land follows the same line. And also traditionally, it is the women who basically are leaders of the clan houses. But then in meetings, it is the men who basically speak out on behalf of their women folks.
Ursula is worried about the effect that modern influences are having on youth and culture of the Carterets, a problem that will surely grow when the islanders move.
Previously, as a small girl growing up on the atolls, we had big respect for our elders. We learned together, and our games were always about life on the island. It was simple games, but games that we truly enjoyed. Swimming in the sea, playing touch. I don't play them anymore, and I also don't see the children of today playing those games anymore. They are now playing other games that they basically observe or learn from those other kids on mainland Bougainville or in Buka. So life has changed, and it's changing dramatically.
What kind of changes?
I think most of the negative changes taking place on Carteret is got to do with a lot of our young people not having much to do at home or not having anything at all. And before, I didn't see any of our young boys drinking homebrew or drinking jungle juice. This was something that was unheard of. Nowadays, boys who are less than 15 years of age are getting into drinking, and this is a change that is very, very negative in our society. A generation of youth also seeing the islands being washed away before their very eyes, so like, what does the future hold for them?
I witnessed the flooding while staying on the Carterets. That evening, I recorded what I saw. And I walked across the island to the banana plantation where some friends of mine were growing bananas. And I realised that the water was coming in. And that where I had been the other day was now underwater. And where I was going to was flooding. And then I realised that the water, the tide was actually pushing the water into the gardens. And it's a very slow thing. It's a very silent thing. There's no big crash. There's no, my God, we're flooding. Very quietly, the water comes up and just overtakes the land. The islanders are very quiet about it too. There's no running around trying to sandbag this or stop this. They've resigned to the fact that this is happening. And they watch it, and it's almost like a mourning. They're actually very quiet, very sad. Some of the people pick up their banana plants, they actually dig them up if the salt water's getting towards them and try and move them somewhere else. And other people are collecting firewood and anything else that they can grab before it gets too wet. Slowly further, the water just keeps coming in, and then, and nobody knows when it's going to stop. The time that I witnessed, it went in about 600 metres. It didn't flood deeply. It flooded to about shin height. And then it pulled out that evening, leaving great pools of water. Although the water is salted, it's still waterlogged land, so next time the water comes in, eventually it'll become a malaria breeding area. That's where the most significant problem for the islanders are at the moment. Early next morning, I visit the local health clinic. Quiet children sit in their mother's arms as the nurse administers small doses of quinine and other antimalarials. Malaria is on the rise, and the two health clinics are kept busy. Saltwater pools have formed breeding areas for malaria mosquitoes. Ursula tells me about the problem.
With the continuous flooding, and then, you know, the flooding also creates, it basically gives chances for mosquitoes to breed, and so there is an increase in of malaria on the islands. And we've had situations where people have died because of malaria.
Returning to the mainland from the Carterets, I took a 3-hour trip across open sea. When there is a storm or strong winds, which can last a couple of weeks, contact is impossible. Ursula talks to me about how this affects the food supply and the health of the islanders.
Last month and the month of June, we saw very heavy storms, and so the boats, the banana boats on Carterets were not able to come to mainland Bougainville, and also people from Buka were not able to travel to the islands, and this went on for almost 2 months. So basically it meant that people didn't really have much to eat on the islands. At the moment we are basically feeding on coconut and dry fish. We have lost our staple food, which has been swamp taro, which we used to live on before. So this imbalances of people's diet, and it, especially it affects children, because when they do not have balanced meals or they do not have anything to eat in the mornings, they do not concentrate and simply do not go to school.
I can see the malnourishment amongst the children. It's obvious by their swollen bellies. I visit the vegetable gardens that are devastated by the salt water. Yellowing leaves of the staple food swamp taro are wilting, and the roots are no longer healthy enough to support the plant. The gardens are no longer able to feed the islanders. I can see the relief on the faces of the people as the local island hopper, the Sunkamuk, enters the lagoon to deliver the rice. I hop on the boat and speak to Paul Nabasi, He is the Minister of Atolls in the autonomous region of Bougainville.
There is no food available locally here, maybe because of the rise in sea level, which is affecting the growth and the yielding of the food crops in here. So at the moment, there is absolutely nothing people rely on to sustain the population on the island.
Bernard travels over to meet the sun come up to collect supplies.
So you've come here from Pule?
That's right. We have a number of people, could number to 200 to 300.
Have these people been waiting a long time for this rice?
Absolutely. We've been waiting for it for almost 6 months.
Do you have to pay for the rice?
No, it's freely given by the government.
How many packets of rice will each family get?
Each family is expected to get per head at least 17 packets.
Okay.
There are 7 islands on the Carteret Atoll. I take a banana boat to Wene, the smallest and most eroded of the islands. It will be the first to go. There I meet Selena, the mother of the last family living on Wene.
How do you find trying to feed all your children?
We are already used to the life of this island, and I think most of the time we have just coconuts and fish. We do grow bananas. We cannot harvest bananas every day, so maybe once a month or twice in a month we have bananas, but that comes in between just having coconuts and fish.
Do you think that's a balanced diet for your children?
It's not balanced, but we cannot help it. We it's helpless here. I understand it's not balanced, but cannot help it. The rice that we received recently, 3 to 4 days ago, is really a relief to us and our kids. We used to have supplies like that, but we cannot really rely on that all the time. Sometimes the government won't have enough money to pay for these rations to come.
After witnessing the flood, I return to Australia with a question. Why are the Carteret Islands disappearing into the Pacific Ocean faster than can be explained by current rising sea levels? As it happens, one of the leading researchers on sea levels is John Hunter. He lives in Tasmania.
Now, the interesting thing about the Carterets is that they don't appear to have had any problems until about the 1980s, 1970s, 1980s. They seem to have lived there for a few centuries with no problems at all, and these problems only started in the last, let's say, 20 years. If I look at the sea level records, the main thing I see in the last 20 years is just the continuation of this steady rise of sea level. So you're talking about a rise of 1 or 2 millimetres a year, say. But on top of that, is superimposed on that are the El Nino oscillations. And the most obvious thing is that these have increased since about the 1970s, in fact. In normal conditions, if you like, non-El Nino conditions, the west of the equator is warm, and most of the rain forms over that area in the west of the west of the Pacific. When you get in El Nino conditions, the wind patterns change slightly. The rain pattern and this warm area moves towards the east, and consequently you get quite dramatic changes of weather both on the western and eastern side of the Pacific, and you also get a change of sea level. From the point of view of the discussion at the moment, the important thing is that during an El Nino, the sea level in the western Pacific falls by something like 30 or 40 centimetres, and it can do that over only about a period of about a year during the duration of an El Nino. And the El Nino's increasing means that sea level falls significantly more than it has in the past. And so these falls of about 30 or 40 centimetres are now probably producing the the lowest sea level that they've observed probably in the last century, so throughout the whole of the last century. So that's just it's a bit of a tantalising puzzle, that it may be that it's actually the low sea level that's causing some problem. It may be destabilising the sediment supply. The dominant thing that I see in sea level records isn't the sea level rise at the moment, although that is there. The dominant thing you see over the last 20 to 30 years is this increase of the depths to which the sea goes down during an El Nino cycle, and then it goes back to normal again and rises quite rapidly. So these are quite dramatic effects on the Pacific sea level.
It was a surprising answer. The effects of the El Nino cycle on the Pacific ecosystem are complex. I wonder if these changes are a direct result of climate change. When the sea level drops, the coral is exposed to the sun, and in the lagoon here on the Carterets, I can see the bleached dead coral. I talked to Bernard about John Hunter's theory.
Now you can, when it's low tide, you can walk from one island to another, and it's so easy. But the problem is we are losing all our corals and stones that were housing this fish that we live on, reef fish especially. The area is so huge and heavily bleached, and no longer fish is being caught there, because what else is there for them to survive on? We've been trying to get some specialist to go and see how the island came about and why is it that so many of our coral and rocks and stones are being heavily bleached. We have not had specialists coming to see our island now.
The other factor is the fact that the islands are naturally very vulnerable. These are coral atoll islands. They are basically sustained by sediment transport. By this I mean that they're in a constant state of flux. There's an external coral reef which is continually growing. That tends to get broken up by the waves. The sediment from the broken coral then flows inshore and actually builds the islands up. And then a lot of that sediment then actually passes over the islands and finishes up in the lagoon, which is generally in the middle of all of these coral atoll groups. So you only don't have to do very much to disrupt the sediment transport, and that can then lead to changes in the islands, substantial changes in the islands.
There's two main islands there, Puel and Hune, and at certain times of the year they can walk between the two, which they've never been able to do. But what's also happening is that when it goes down that far, it exposes the coral and the coral starts to die.
They've actually said that to you, have they, about the coral dying? Or?
Yeah, I can see it. You can see the bleaching.
Okay. I mean, that would be my theory, but it's nice for somebody to actually go and say they've seen it.
There have been questions raised as to whether the islands are actually sinking due to the movements of tectonic plates. I asked John Hunter about that.
I'm not an expert on tectonic plate movement, but I do talk to people who are. The Carterets lie on the Pacific plate, reasonably near the edge of it. Measurements made near that area suggest that there is not a large vertical motion. There's quite a strong horizontal motion of the plate, and that is a movement from the east to the west, quite a strong movement, but that obviously wouldn't give rise to any apparent sea level rise. Any vertical motion, as far as I understand, you'd expect to be reasonably steady at the location of the Carteret Islands.
Back on the island, Bernard tells me the story of Tana Kahune, daughter of the octopus and the eel. It's a story that focuses on displacement and the islander's connection to the ocean.
This is a beautiful girl, young, light skin, long hair. Her mother was octopus, and her father was eel, sea eel. Very early in the morning, Tana Kahune would come and collect hibiscus, beautiful flowers, you know, hibiscus flowers, and line them in her hair. And one time, there was a young man who came very early in the morning and saw this beautiful woman. I've never seen such a beautiful girl. I must try and capture her. And then one time he grabbed her, but her skin was oily, like fish or eels. You know, you hold them and they're slippery. So similar slippery skin she had. So Tanuke would escape from this young fellow. And then one time he thought to himself, I must do something. So he made this net. And there is a hole there, and that's the hole where Tanukehu would come out and go in. So he went and put a net over the hole. So that's how this young man got hold of Tanukehu by the help of a fishing net, and brought her home to his parents. And she bore him a child. So when the child was small, the parents of Tanukehu, Octopus, the mother, and the eel from the sea, also wanted to see their grandchild. So the husband was away, and when he came back from his fishing trip, he came in and saw the place was full of octopus and eels and relatives of Tanukehu. And he said, gosh, what are these people doing here? They are not human. His wife said, well, they are my parents. I should be with them. Oh, I don't want them here. They'll kill the child, you know. They're horrible looking things. And started kicking them around. And Tanukehu said to herself, I must wait for my husband to go fishing again. And then I'll return back. And when the husband came back, there was no Tanukehu, no child. He went to where the hole is, and he knocked, and the response was, who's knocking? Me, the husband. And he said, sorry, you're not allowed to get our daughter because you humiliated us. So he put his hand down to try and pull the hole. Something chopped off the hand. And another one, and the legs, and both legs, and so the as the story goes, the man just floated back to the shore, no hand, no legs, as a dead wood.
A few years ago, a group of islanders attempted to relocate to the mainland Bougainville. Soon after they moved, a civil war erupted.
In Papua New Guinea, rebels on Bougainville have made their biggest strike yet, killing 7 people on the island. Rob Rashke.
With hostilities between rebels and security forces at an all-time high, the latest militant attack came just after midnight when they launched the
Bougainville. I asked Bernard about how he remembers the war.
The government of Papua New Guinea showed that the police were helpless, so the army was sent in. But by the time there were already people who were being shot for nothing, beaten up, beaten unconsciously, and it was no longer a fight between the landowners and the company, but a fight between the black people of Bougainville fighting against the redskins of Papua New Guinea.
About 15 to 20,000 people died during that crisis.
Which is about 10% of the population.
Yes.
One in 10 people.
That's right. And we suffered blockade. Our people in the cartridge, they were not fighting, but of course they also felt the economic blockade that was placed by Papua New Guinea government.
It's been 8 years since the ceasefire, but still many Cataract Islanders are afraid to move to a place that they associate with lethal violence. Back on Wene, in the Cataracts, I asked Selena, how does she see her future?
Do you think you'll enjoy your life in Bougainville when you do move?
I've lived in Bougainville before, and I've seen what it was like there during the crisis, and sort of dislike what I saw. Maybe I'll adapt to it, but it's not like living on the island. I like this place. Maybe I'll really miss the island, because it's so peaceful here. Not too many people live here, and it's quiet. So I just stay around most of the time. Maybe I'm lazy, but I like it here.
Back in Tasmania, I talked to the scientist John Hunter. I asked him, do you think relocation is inevitable for the Carteret people?
Probably the best thing is to look at what global sea level is doing, because this is basically what the Carterets have generally been following, something like global sea level. There's nothing particularly unusual about them. So globally, sea level rose something like about 1.5 to 2 millimetres a year during the last century. But towards the end of the century, it's been rising quite a lot faster, around about 3 millimetres a year. So for the last 10 to 20 years, sea level's been rising nearly twice as fast as it was over the last century. We're not sure if this is really a genuine acceleration or whether it's part of a long-term oscillation and we'll see the sea level rise, the rate of sea level rise, decreasing in the future. But what we do know is from the climate projections that we do expect sea level ultimately to accelerate, probably to reach something of order between 0.5 metre and about 0.9 metre by the end of this century relative to today.
So what you're saying is it's inevitable that these islands will be lost.
That, I think, is that's the take-home message. That the way I like to look at islands like the Carterets and Tuvalu and other Pacific islands and Indian Ocean islands, what we are observing at the moment cannot generally be explained just by sea level rise. There's a number of other things happening. A lot of these problems are obviously erosional. It's not just that the sea level's rising and the rising relative to the land. It's basically that a lot of the land is getting eroded back. Some of these things we might be able to reverse. Obviously, in cases where you can't reverse it, and especially certainly where islands in the future, where the maximum height of the islands is of the same order as the amount of sea level rise we're going to expect, say, in this century, then there's nowhere for the people to retreat to. They actually have to leave the islands, obviously.
When I talk to Ursula, I find that she agrees with John Hunter.
The islanders of Cartridge will have to be resettled. Basically, we could identify a plantation where we can settle these people. Like, we are looking at more than 300 to 400 hectares of land where we can start to begin to move islanders, because we are talking here about cultural identity, cultural values, customs at play, and all that kind of thing. So we've got to be sensitive to where we put these people.
I asked Bernard what sort of effect the move from the island will have on his culture.
These areas, sacred areas, have been there since time immemorial, you know, centuries after century, and we don't know exactly when they were were started as sacred areas. But when we move onto the mainland of Bougainville, we'll lose those areas. And that is why our older people do not want to leave these islands, because of those ties. They feel that if they move, you're moving them away from their own strength, their own self, you know. These traditional values are intact because of the distance we have away from the mainland of Bougainville and of course Buka. So it's only at home that we practice our customary values, our traditional culture.
The men are more, they are holding back. And I think because in our society, men basically sit underneath coconut palms and do nothing but tell stories and only wait for the food to be cooked so that they can just go back and feed themselves.
So who is forcing the action to leave the island?
It is basically a decision that is being encouraged by women because of the way they see themselves and their future generation. We cannot always talk about fishing grounds and being next to the sea. We've got to think about adjusting to any location that we move to. I think in this situation, the women are very much willing to adapt to whatever comes face to face or whatever challenges come with the new relocation.
We are victims of something we are not responsible for. We become marginalized because of not of our own making. We are refugees because of somebody outside who's not conscious of what they are doing in destabilizing this ecosystem. You know?
Do you think Australia has a role to play?
The good people of Australia and the government especially, that you are the superpower in the Pacific, you play a major part in the Pacific region, you are generous in giving millions to smaller countries in the Pacific in trying to help them alleviate this poverty problem. Our case is totally different. Will they be able to compensate us for losing our land, losing our swamp taro, losing almost our ancestral spirits and our ancestral grounds and cemeteries and areas we regarded as very sacred? And when you lose that, you are nobody. Because these areas are your roots, they are your strength, they are your lives, and we are able to survive because of them. And these are traditional values, these are traditional practices that we've been, we are born into it. And we're helpless at the moment. You know?
It's probably too late to save the Carterets. The sea is taking away the land at an aggressive rate. And these people have a limited time on the islands that they call home. They know what's happening to them is not of their own making, and they feel powerless to do anything about it. The culture that survived on these picturesque islands will no longer be there in 20 years. The inhabitants must relocate. This is a small story, but it paints a much larger picture of the climate change issues that will confront all of us in the 21st century. Bernard reads a poem he wrote.
Graveyard of hopes. I can only see a drifting coconut floating in a menacing sea. I hang on to my dreams, salvaged from a disturbed nights of broken hopes. The cataract in my eyes has smudged my sight. I am almost a broken man. Sadness and fear have taken refuge in my contrite hand. My world is but a submerged island of shattered dreams and battered landscape. I can only see a submerged island of wasteland, battered by huge waves and littered by fragments of dead coral and driftwood. I can feel the pang in my tummy, but the fish are gone now, and the gardens are but a barren landscape. So I cannot feed my tummy. Hunger is cruelly feeding on me. I am but a feeble man. I can only see spiteful waves eating away the last portion of island, where I now take refuge. I no longer have the strength to endure and the courage to hold on to my hopes, stalked by the marauding sea. I try to hold on to my dreams and hopes as I wait my dead ride in one of the killer tides. I can no longer see a drifting coconut, nor can I dream dreams anymore. As I finally find myself submerged in the enemy tide, there is no longer an island, but an abyss of sea. I want to change into a fish to be able to survive. For now, let the cruel tide carry me to the graveyard of hopes.
A Drifting Coconut, Stories from the Carteret Islands. And this documentary was produced for Radio I by Catherine Gough Brady and Thomas Parkinson. The sound engineer was Kerry Dell. The supervising producers for Radio I were Tony Barrell and Sharon Davis. And you can hear the program again by going to the Radio I website at abc.net.au/rn/Radio I, where this feature can be heard as audio on demand for the next 4 weeks, and it's also available as an MP3 download. You can add your comments to our guest book. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up in a few minutes, a story about disappearing water rather than vanishing land, the runaway lake. But to get us there, a lament from Malaita, one of the Solomon Islands. It's the song of a young man who, upon returning from visiting his girlfriend, finds his father has died. Ama Mata, performed on panpipes by the Are Are people. Ama Mata, a lament performed on bamboo panpipes by the Are Are people of the Solomon Islands. The composer was Hopu, and it was taken from a 1976 recording of music performed at the South Pacific Festival of Arts in Rotorua, New Zealand. Coming up, The Runaway Lake. On a rainy October morning, the residents of Newcastle, a small lakeside town in the state of Maine on the east coast of the United States, woke up to a startling surprise. Their lake, Sherman Lake, had disappeared overnight. In Newcastle, the runaway lake was big news. Producer Callie Carswell visited Newcastle to find out what happened next.
I happened to be called by my fire chief. You know, I got there with a flashlight. It was kind of dark still, raining. And it was like, wow, I've never seen so much water come down through a place before. So I went back out the next morning to see what happened. And basically, Sherman Lake disappeared overnight. It just flowed away. At that point, nothing we could do but, you know, kind of cry that it was gone, wondering what was going to happen or how it was going to be put back together.
He goes out to get the New York Times early in the morning, and I was in here making coffee. And he walked in, and he said, look out the window. And I impatiently said, why? And he said, you don't live on a lake anymore.
I think he called me and said, the lake is gone,
and
the lake
I said,
is gone.
Gone? What do you mean it's gone?
I just couldn't
Where'd
believe it.
Go?
Sherman Lake was gone.
And I just stood there in utter
I think
utter
it was total
amazement.
Just shocked that it was gone.
It was almost like a whole time period was gone.
I just thought, wow, it's wow. I mean, that's pretty much all you can say when it's gone.
That man-made lake has been there 70 years.
It was called Sherman Lake, and one could see that it was a more or less a popular place.
It was really scenically beautiful, you know, absolutely beautiful.
It's, I think at the deepest point it was like 11 or 12 feet, but it was great for bass. We had bass and sunfish and perch and, you know, things
it's
you
a great place to kids because you could always catch a fish there.
It was easy, cheap recreation.
You'll see canoes and kayaks, and I know
lots
of people.
Duck hunting, goose hunting, ice fishing, of course. And
so it was an easy kind of lake, just a sort of locals kind of place.
And that's the way it was before the dam went out.
The dam at Sherman Lake failed on Columbus Day weekend. We had very heavy rain.
It was torrential rain.
It was a lot of water, more than most
of us. And the wind was just unbelievable.
And throughout the county, you had a lot of washed out roads. It wasn't a very fun week for anybody, really.
It was the old road bed that washed out.
The dam was actually the old Route 1.
And it just, you know, all gushed away downriver.
And things happened and changed, and that's all there is to it. They couldn't handle the power of nature is what happened to it.
When I saw it, it was all mud flat. Water had just absolutely disappeared.
All the people have disappeared. And there's no activity out here. Really none since the breach.
You know, you drive by some days, the tide is coming in, and there's a little bit more water in there than other days. There's nothing at all.
I think a lot of us thought that they were going to fix it.
I never dreamed the day that it was breached that it wouldn't be repaired.
A lot of us didn't realize what was in the air.
And then all the rumbling started.
The issue was whether we should rebuild the dam or not rebuild the dam.
There was a small group in the town of Newcastle that got together and expressed their dismay that the dam had blown out.
I was a lunatic in the beginning.
There was the other contingent of people that said, you know, originally it was a marsh. It wasn't a lake.
I mean, how can you quarrel with the fact that it's more natural than it was? Isn't more natural better?
The letters to the editor were prolific.
There were
articles in the
articles
local
in the
paper were abundant.
A few so letters to the editor.
We have an interesting population who's not afraid to give their opinion, that's for sure.
Someone started batting the ball around that it would cost $1 million to fix it. That
some people just aren't willing to pay more taxes.
It wasn't until the holidays and the potential Walmart that it fell out of the top topic in the local newspaper.
So it was the subject of a lot of debate, a lot of conversation back and forth.
I mean, this was the event of the town. It was the front page of the town report.
And ultimately, so our final decision was, no, we're not going to rebuild the dam. And in fact, we would like to complete the restoration there.
They figured Mother Nature took back what she wanted, and they were going to leave it that way at this point, I believe.
They said once upon a time people were making dams and making lakes, and that was great for recreation. But fortunately, the Department of Transportation is not in the dam business anymore.
Step away for a moment and just imagine if you
brought lakefront property that you thought you'd built on one of the most beautiful places you'd ever seen in your life. You have 2 years on it and it's gone. We didn't feel like the luckiest people in the world, I'll tell you that.
I've lost the fishing. I can't take the kids there anymore.
So it's some history lost. And I wonder about what my dad would have been thinking if he was still alive, and people who had lived here all their lives. Of course, most of the people that grew up here are now gone. This is a new generation around here, so they can adjust to it.
I was never that enthralled with Sherman Lake. And the world needs, the coast needs, Maine needs more tidal marshes. To me, it was sort of an ironic twist to history or something that lake that I looked at for so many years was once again a tidal marsh, and it was like somehow the hand of fate had put it back.
A lake is beautiful. A salt marsh is beautiful. They both have great things to offer. To me, the downfall of the lake is that it was a man-made lake. So I guess I like to think that, you know, we can flow with the change.
We've gone there so many years that, you know, it's just, it'll be a hole this summer. I'll miss it.
I'm sure people will get used to it in time, like anything happens, but it is, you know, I think it's a good loss to the town.
Like I said, it's been 6 months now, and I just kind of look at it and say, oh, it's not so bad. You know, I'll get used to it.
You know, over time, things have changed. It does it everywhere. It's a sign of progress, I guess they call it.
You know, you just change your coat or change your shirt or change your hat, continue on, because that's what's going to happen.
And I still have trouble picturing Sherman Lake in my mind now. It's as if the vision of that just left as quickly as the marsh began.
The Runaway Lake was produced by Callie Carswell at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies in Portland, Maine. And that's about it for Radio I this week. Glad you could join us. Next week, we bring the climate change story home, where it becomes very close and personal.
What makes the electricity fascist the electricity fascist is his ability to point out, almost before you've left the room.
You've left the light on, darling. Have you finished with the computer? Darling, why is the light on in the kitchen? Could you shut the door? You're letting the heat out.
You know the electricity fascist has a point. You keep up with the news. You're aware of global warming, and you'd like to be the type of person who turns the light out. Really, truly, you would. But somehow, you're a prisoner to that old warden habit.
You've left the light on again.
Sorry.
Don't apologise to me. Apologise to Tuvalu.
That's a bit from Apologies to Tuvalu, bringing climate change home in Radio I, here on ABC Radio National, next week at this time. I'm Brent Clough, and I hope you can join me then. Studio production today has been by Manny Wasserstrom and Tony McGregor. And that's the program. In the meantime, I invite you to stay with Radio National for lots more great ideas and good radio.
ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.